Be doing. I thank you all for the courage to come to this meeting. For some, I know it's difficult. I remember my first one. I would guess that some of you are married. I would guess that some of you are single. I would guess that some of you have acted out on that same sex lust, and some of you have thought about it. But we're all in the same boat. We're all dealing with a disease that this program is designed to help us deal with. And I'm just so grateful for this program because it's a miracle that I stand here before you today to share my story with you. One of my character defects when I did my fourth step was perfectionism. And so my tendency, of course, would be to want to make this meeting today a perfect meeting. But you know what? It's not going to be. And I'm okay with that today. I also chose not to prepare for it, other than just a few little notes. When I did my first step, it was 25 pages long, because it had to be perfect. The first time I was asked to share in a speaker's meeting, I wanted to be sure I got every word right. And so I wrote it out in preparation for that meeting. Today I've got 25 words maybe scribbled on a piece of paper that hopefully will just kind of guide me through a few points that I want to make. With the limited amount of time, I wasn't sure. There were very little instructions as to what these meetings were to be and how much time we had, or even the nature of the meeting. And so I wrestled a little bit with what we should do here during this 45 minutes. And I decided that what I would do is probably be selfish in some ways and take up a good part of the time myself as I share my story with you. But I share it not because it's my story, but it's because it's my higher power story and what he has done in and through my life as a result of this program. And I share it because I hope that some of you that came in the door today, maybe for the first time, are looking for some hope. And there is hope, as my story, I think, will illustrate. My acting out history did not begin until I was in my 30s. I was married. I had three kids. I was a college professor. I taught in the area of theater. I was a theater arts guy, an actor, a director. Prior to my 30s, lust was not an issue for me, same sex or otherwise. I enjoyed my family. I enjoyed my wife. Thought we had it all pretty much together. But some interesting things started to happen in my life. One of which was I developed a relationship with one of my students, a male student. It was not sexual. It was an artistic relationship. We started getting together to write together and share together. And then we started kind of opening up to one another about important things in our lives. And we started to talk about spiritual things. I was not a spiritual person at all. I believed in God, that was about it, but I was not a spiritual person at all. And so that relationship started to open up a lot of new areas for me. Some other things happened too that there's no time to go into. But one point, the two of us needed to take a trip together to scout out a place where we might do some creative work together. And I had my first homosexual sexual experience on that trip with him. I came home to my wife, and she was not surprised. In fact, she said she could see it coming and knew it was probably going to happen, even more than I did, to be honest. I didn't see it coming. It was a total surprise. As I look back on that experience through the eyes of recovery, however, I realize to a certain degree what was going on. This was the first male person that I ever knew how to be intimate with. And it ended up being sexual. Of course, the interesting thing was once it became sexual, it destroyed the relationship too, which is a very, very sad thing. but I didn't realize it at the time. But there was something about bonding with another person on a very deep level, on a spiritual level, on an artistic level, on a one-to-one personal, being very vulnerable. I had never done that, certainly not with any of my male friends. Looking back, realized I didn't really have any male friends, a lot of acquaintances, but I realized I never really bonded with anyone. You know, when in my day, and some of you may be in my same age category, people didn't move the way they do now. And I graduated from high school with people that I started kindergarten with, and graduated from high school, never saw them again. I never bonded with anyone. Certainly didn't bond with my father. Loved him. I knew he loved me. But we didn't know how to express it to one another. It was just a given. There was that feeling, that sense of, yeah, we love each other, but we never said those words. In fact, it wasn't until I was in recovery and one time my sponsor said he loved me and I about choked. I didn't know what to do with that word because I hadn't known how to even say it. Frankly, not even to my wife, except in very shallow sorts of ways. So anyhow, after that experience, circumstances, God was good, circumstances brought about a move. We were living in California at the time, Northern California, and we had to move to Minnesota, and so that helped break off that relationship. Although my wife met with him one-on-one and kind of talked through the whole experience, and off we went to Minnesota. But unfortunately for me, the hook had been set. I wanted that again, and I started to seek it out. And so for me, it was very slow at first, took a good number of years, really, very, very slowly, but I started the process of searching out other men, public places, parks, so forth. I got caught in a department store. Why I wasn't turned over to the police, I'll never know, because there was even an article in the paper that people from that very place had been caught and were in the news. I got caught another time in a shopping mall by a former student of mine. He was the security force in the shopping mall, and he came up to me and he realized who it was, and I knew who he was. And grace of God, he just ignored it, and as though, you know, we both knew what was going on, but he didn't say anything, and I was let, you know, we just kind of had a little conversation, how are you doing, caught up with one another, and moved on. I should say, too, I was working in a Christian institution at the time, so this added to the fear of being found out, certainly added to the shame, certainly added to, you know, the paranoia of wondering who might see me and where and when and so forth. Next time I got caught, or almost got caught, so again in a public park. I was always very, very cautious, though. Good thing, otherwise I probably wouldn't be here today. This time was kind of a standoff, and it turned out it was a police officer, plainclothes police officer. And he finally just said, look, I know why you're here. Just get out of here. And I did, you know. But he could have, you know, he could have put me away. Well, that terrified me. That absolutely terrified me. But I couldn't stop. Couldn't stop doing this stuff. But that was enough for me to say, you know what, I can't do this public stuff anymore. And it drove me underground and indoors. We moved again. We moved back to California, this time to the Los Angeles area. Well, that was not a good thing. Started working in the area of film and in the film business, the Hollywood scene, all of that stuff, and my acting out started to increase. And because I was no longer going to take the risk of public exposure, I went indoors and I found the bathhouses and the sex clubs and the internet, of course, and chat rooms. And over a period of good number of years, probably 20, 25 years, it just escalated and escalated and escalated. I brought home crabs one time, terrified that I would pass them on to my wife, but found them in time and disposed of it and said, well, no more, no more back to those places. Of course, that happened two or three more times. Went for those dreaded tests every time, relieved that they were negative, and vowing, okay, another negative test. I'll never, ever do that again. But what I was learning, of course, not really understanding, but what I was learning was this is a progressive disease. Because it didn't matter what line I drew, I eventually crossed it. And it began to eat away, well, it really began to eat away at my soul. Because as a result of that first experience with that young man and my spirituality being born, I had really had a great religious conversion experience that was kind of mixed up with that first experience. And over these years of acting out, that the vitality of that faith experience, that spiritual experience, began to diminish just as my acting out was increasing. Never realized the connection between those two until I got into recovery. Well, it got pretty bad. I was in a work situation again, and working for a Christian organization. My boss was in Washington, D.C. I was in Los Angeles, so I had no accountability. I was in charge. Isn't it odd that I usually was in charge, no matter where I was in my life? And so there was no accountability, and I had a lot of flexibility with my time, and I spent all that time acting out. And by the end, it was almost 24 hours a day. If I wasn't acting out, I was thinking about it and plotting it and planning it. And, it was total insanity. And, of course, it was laced with a tremendous sense of hypocrisy, a tremendous sense of shame. I always felt very transparent. I thought everybody knew. I thought they could see through me, especially my family, my kids. I had four kids. I thought they all knew. And as a result, of course, I put up fences around me, kept everyone away from me, because I didn't want them to ever feel comfortable enough around me to ask. Yeah. Eventually, I was in the middle of an acting out experience, and God intervened. I didn't hear an audible voice, but God spoke to me and basically said, you don't need this. You have me. And that was the last time that I ever acted out with another person, that I had sex with another male. But of course, I was still in the addiction. I was masturbating. I was on the internet. I was having phone sex. All of that stuff continued for at least another year. Well, one day I got an email in the middle of the afternoon from, another former student of mine. And I misread it. And I think that was a God thing. I misread it. I thought he was saying, Doug, I know about your secret life. And I went into total panic. I had a panic attack. I thought I was having a heart attack. I realized it really was a panic attack. I went into chills and sweats, and I just thought I was going to curl up and die on the floor because it was the fear of now being found out and exposed to not only my wife and my children, but probably my career and my sense of hoping that I still had some kind of a reputation left was just devastating, the thought of that. But at the end of that period, I realized I cannot keep living like this anymore. I just can't. I don't care what the circumstances will be. I've got to get clean about this. I've got to become honest. And it is interesting as we look, once I got into recovery and looked in the big book and realized that, rigorous honesty is the key. It's finally being honest. I didn't know it then, but, out of desperation, I decided to be honest. My wife came home that afternoon, and I dumped. I dumped 30 years of acting out on her, told her what had been going on for all of these years. She was shocked, but later on, after the shock, she also said, "You know, I always wondered," because of course she knew about the first experience. She said, "I always wondered," and she identified, like, "I wondered when this and when that," and it was like a checklist. She knew what was going on. And she, of course, got into her own program to recognize how she was a codependent and in denial and so on and so forth. But I also got on the phone and called all four of my kids. They were all adults by this time, and told them. I hadn't read the big book yet. Didn't know I wasn't supposed to share all this, but I did. And not a lot of the details. And bless my wife. Her wisdom to not ask for the details has been an incredible blessing. She didn't want to know all of the details. If she had asked, I would have told her, but I think that was a really healthy choice on her part. I even hesitated when they said this session was going to be recorded, because you're probably hearing more of details of my story than my wife has heard. Not much more, but... So I thought, okay, it's done. And of course, the email, I went back and read it, and that's not what was being said at all, but it was out now, and I thought, finally, I'm free. But of course, I wasn't, because I wasn't in a program. I didn't know I needed a program. So days, weeks, months went on, and I was right back into the old patterns, not of acting out with other men, but of being on the internet and, you know, chatting and phone sex and so forth. A whole year went by, almost to the day, and my wife came home one afternoon, and she walked in the room, and I was on the internet, and she looked at me, and she just said, "It's not over, is it?" And I said, "No, it's not. It's not. I know it. It's not over. I don't know what to do." When I was in the depths of my despair, I had thought about suicide, but that was not an option for me, because I knew that my wife's father had committed suicide when she was a teenager, and she was the one that found him. And so I knew that I could not do that to her again. I could not do that. So that was not an out for me. So now we're facing this dilemma of, it's not over. Now what? Well, my wife again went out and she found some resources for me. And she knew me well enough to know that she couldn't tell me what to do, but she could make some suggestions, and that's what she did. She called around and found some therapists that specialized in addiction. Sexual addiction, particularly with people in clergy. I had been a clergyman in part of those years too. She had a friend whose husband was in SA, and she got a hold of the white book. And so one evening she said, "Here's three or four names of therapists for you, and here's this book. It's up to you." And I had never wanted to do therapy or marriage counseling, or, you know, we needed it. We didn't know how to communicate. We didn't. We later realized we never knew how to fight. And so our way of dealing with life was that my wife would take all of her resentments and store them away. I used to refer to it as her quiver. She had this quiver full of arrows, and they were all the resentments, and she would hang on to them. And no matter what, you know, if we would ever get into any, the slightest kind of an argument, out with, they would come. You know, it would be, "Well, remember when?" You know, and I'm going, "I don't remember." Because, see, I had another way of dealing with it. I acted out. So she stored them up. I got rid of them by acting out. So anyhow, I sat down, I read the white book, and I thought, oh my goodness, there's a name for this. I'm a sexaholic. I'm a sexaholic. Well, there was good news and bad news in that. The bad news was, I'm a sexaholic for the rest of my life. But the good news was, there's a program of help if I'd be willing to work it. So I thought, okay, I'll look into this. And being sort of anal, I had to get on the internet and check out all about sexual addiction and about the recovery programs and all, and I discovered there were multiple programs, and I knew that there was one that particularly seemed to be supported by people from the homosexual community. And I thought, well, that's what my acting out's been. That's where I probably belong. And so my very first 12-step meeting was a meeting at noon in Hollywood with this particular 12-step program. And I walked in the room, of course, terrified to go to a meeting for the first time. But I also realized it was a room full of triggers for me. And I thought, well, this isn't going to help. I knew that right away. This was not going to be a help. In fact, when the group gathered for the Lord's Prayer, I just slipped out the door. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And I went to another one of the 12-step groups, addiction groups, where you have your opportunity to be selective about your bottom line and your sobriety definition, and they were very pleasant and warm, and I kind of liked them. And I thought, well, yeah, but it was this book that made me realize that I was a sexaholic. Maybe I should check out SA, but, you know, I read their sobriety definition, and I thought, I don't know. I wonder if I will even be accepted in SA. But God is so good. I went to my newcomer meeting, and it just so happened that night the person leading the newcomer meeting struggled with the same issues that I struggled with, and I knew I was home. I knew I was home. I went to that meeting that night. It was a fairly large meeting in Southern California, probably 30 people in the room, and I was astounded because by the end of that hour, I felt like I knew those people better than the people that I had gone to kindergarten to high school with. And they were from every walk of life. They were from every profession. But we were all alike in a particular way. And I knew they understood what I was dealing with. And again, I felt like I was home. Well, I jumped into recovery with the same enthusiasm that I worked my addiction. I read everything I could. I started to go to meetings. I went to 5 or 6 a week for 2 or 3 years at least. I got into service positions as soon as I could. Within the first month, I asked someone to be my sponsor. And interestingly enough, my sponsor, the person I chose to be ask to be my sponsor, his acting out was not same-sex at all. In fact, he was even younger than 2 of my kids. But I just felt like as I heard him share that there was something that I could relate to him, and I thought, well, maybe he could relate to me. And he was a gift. I mean, he was an incredible gift to me, saved my life. I miss him a lot. He left the program eventually. Got into therapy for the first time, same thing. Terrified of the thought of therapy, and found just the right therapist, and we connected and spent 4 wonderful, deep years together. Got sober right away and stayed sober. Over 9 years of sobriety. It's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle. I started working the steps, and that first step was pretty incredible. My sponsor was in some ways too kind. He didn't know how to tell me that 25 pages is too long for a first step. And he let me read them for my first step. And it's a huge room. It included the founder of our program was in the room that night. Some interesting things happened that night that I don't have time to share, but shared my first step and was so relieved to have that over, although there was some trauma that occurred, that some things happened during the meeting where I almost walked out in the middle of my own first step. And had my sponsor not been sitting next to me and just said, take it easy, Doug, I probably never would have come back, and I certainly wouldn't have been here today. But got through that. My second step, as I worked that step, I began to look at what I had lost in terms of my understanding of my higher power, and started to regain that relationship and made that commitment in the third step. The fourth step changed my life. I hesitated doing it. I went to a retreat. I was probably two and a half years in to the program. Went to a big retreat, men's retreat, that every year happens for people from L.A. And it was a four-step workshop, and I thought, yeah, I should get going on that. So I did at that. Well, it took me a year to write my fourth step. I thought I didn't have any resentments till I started writing them down, and then they began to flow. I need to back up one step, too. One of the things about getting into SA was, well, what about this masturbation issue? Well, for me, I thought, that's not my problem. My problem was what I was doing with other guys. Masturbation was not a big issue for me, but if that's what the program required, fine, I'll do that, too. You know, well, I went into withdrawal. I mean, I had no idea how much that drove my life and how that's how I coped with life. And it, as I stopped masturbating and started getting into recovery and started avoiding the emotions, all of a sudden the emotions started to rise to the surface. And I would go to meetings and they'd ask me to do one of the readings, and I couldn't get through it. I would just start blubbering. And I'd be in my car driving, and I would just start weeping out loud in the car. And it was like, I couldn't understand what was going on. But what I have come to realize since then, of course, was all of that had been bottled up in me for all those years. And I was finally able to start letting it go, you know. The same thing happened in the fourth step. But now it was resentments. Oh, my goodness. And what was my part in them? What was my part? What do you mean, what was my part? Well, my part was all of my character defects. I've already mentioned the perfectionism, you know, the need to judge others, to control, self-image. That really started to come out. And I began to realize, you know, I, in spite of how I had presented myself to people and how I had presented myself to myself, I simply felt like I was worthless, that I had nothing to contribute to anyone. And as I looked back in my acting out, I realized that was probably a large part of it. I wanted somebody to want me. I just needed to be needed, even if it was just sexual, even if it was anonymous. Of course, most of the time I never even got their name. I just needed them, and I used them. They used me, but I used them. Took a long time to do my fifth step with my sponsor. We met many, many times, hours and hours at a time, going over each resentment, one at a time, peeling it back. That's when I learned from him and through his eyes, helping him for me to see my fear of authority and how I dealt with authority, particularly male authority in my life. And then there was the fears list. I started to write, well, what am I afraid of? And at first it was kind of surfacey kinds of things. But it didn't take long before those started to pour out too. And I began to realize that I had led 59 years of my life living in absolute terror, and I didn't even know it, because I had covered it up so well, even to me. And what a relief that was, to be able to set that stuff down and give it away, surrender it, and start to walk free. The other steps were powerful too, the remaining steps, but for me, that's where the turning point came, 4 and 5. I live a different life today. Do I still have temptations and lust? You bet. Not every day, close to it. Do I still want to control? Yeah. but I'm learning to let go of that. Do I still want to be perfect? Yeah, but I've got tools to remind me not to write the speech out, but to just share from your heart. I'm learning, progress, not perfection. I'm really glad that that as a result of this program that I could learn how to communicate with my wife. We decided to follow the suggestion of the White Book and go into a period of celibacy, and that was really healthy for us, especially for me, because I realized I brought the lust into the marriage bed. I wasn't being sexual with her. I was being sexual with myself. I was using it as a relief. I needed to get off, basically, you know. And so by going into a period of celibacy and not acting out and not masturbating, that was really healthy. And that lasted for a period of time. And my wife was the one that finally suggested we break the period of celibacy. And I said, oh, okay. But you know what? I'm still at the point where I do not want to initiate because I know I will use it in an unhealthy way. And so I allowed her to be the one to initiate. And, you know, to a certain extent, we still do that today. More likely to. We're in a much healthier place than we were before. Of course, the big question that has come up a number of times, and some of you probably struggle with it too, and I've been asked a few times, well, how do you think of yourself? You know, are you bi, are you gay, are you what, you know? And first I wasn't quite sure. You see, I always rationalized my acting out with men. It was one way that I rationalized acting out with men was, well, I'm not really hurting my wife because I'm not acting out with other women. That's the crazy addict thinking I had. You know, that was my way of escaping responsibility. But today, as I reflect on that, you know, is it a same sex lust thing or bi or gay or what? You know, I guess I go back to that revelation I had when I read the White Book. There is a name for it, and I'm a sexaholic. Plain and simple. I'm a sexaholic. That's what I am. And I don't need to play around with a lot of other titles and labels and just accept it. That's what I am. I'm a sexaholic. I think I'll leave it at that so we have at least a few minutes for some sharing.
Hi, I'm Alan from Atlanta. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Alan.
I first knew I had same-sex attraction at age 10, and it scared the blank out of me because back then in the 60s, I don't need to go into all that. But I decided to just repress it and push it down and pretend to be straight, have girlfriends, and didn't actually have any acting out. I'm not going to call it sex because it's not sex. I didn't have any acting out with anybody until I was 30. So I really did a lot career-wise between the age of 10 and 30. I got a lot accomplished. Between age 30 and 55, I had inappropriate physical contact with over 10,000 married males who I perceived to be 100% heterosexual, or else I was not interested in them. And in the past year and a half, I've been what I call celibate because of this program. I haven't been using the word sober. When I started working the program and the definition came up of no sex with self or others and no pornography, to me that meant no masturbation, which was not really a problem, but it became a problem when I stopped doing it for about the first 6 months. No sex with others, but I don't call it sex, so I would say no inappropriate physical contact with married males for me, and no pornography, which is not really an issue for me either. So for 18 months, I've been going to meetings saying, you know, I'm either celibate or sober or whatever, and because of this convention, and I'm really great, thank you for your story, first of all. I appreciate your story. It's really great for me to hear married males talk about this stuff. I've never been married. But I'm supposed to pick up an 18-month chip January 28th, and thanks to a session I went to this morning, I now know that not only am I not picking up the chip on January 28th, but I've never been sober for the 18 months because I have been lusting every single day. I have been going to places I shouldn't go just to see who was hanging out there. I was never going to do anything. I had an adult website that I canceled, but I can still receive emails, and I check that every now and then to see if I was getting emails. I've given my phone number to people, total strangers. And even though I haven't masturbated or had inappropriate physical contact with a married man in 18 months, I now know that I'm not sober. So, and I now know why I haven't had any comfort for the past 18 months. So I really appreciate this program, and it's unbelievable to see this many people here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Vicki. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Vicki.
Once again, I'm the only woman in here. Ah, it's okay. When I did my first step 6 years ago, which is possibly one of the most painful things I ever did, one of the things I had to do was admit that I had same-sex attractions or attractions to pictures of women very young, you know, like age 10 or even younger, and that my first obsessions, I'm huge on obsessions, were around girls. And you know, and I did my disease around men. I didn't act out. I was all fantasy and masturbation and porn. That was the extent of my, well, that's enough, basically. But I realized that I lusted after women. And that as my disease progressed, it got worse and worse to the point where, like, right before I joined SA, my big fantasy person was a gay woman who worked in a bookstore down from where I was working, and I was basically stalking her. You know, I would leave my job, sometimes leave my store unattended, and go and see if she was there. And what I would do is I'd go and see if she was there, and if there, I'd try to get her attention, and we'd talk, and, you know, very friendly, everything, whatever, and I'd get my high, then I'd leave. And then I would, of course, take it home and then act out, do sex with self with it. You know, so I could say that, you know, I really wasn't, I don't know, whatever. And I went through sexual addiction treatment way before I went to SA, and I thought that maybe I'd always been very angry at men. I thought that maybe my problem was just that why I was so discomfortable, I wasn't admitting that I was gay. Maybe I was really gay, and then I wouldn't have to deal with men ever, ever, ever. And that didn't turn out to be true. And since I've been in recovery, I've learned that I can sexualize anything. I can sexualize, produce. I mean, it doesn't really matter. And that I particularly, if someone, because I was always hurting, if I met a woman, friend, whatever, and she was nurturing to me, I really was quick to sexualize any kind of nurturance for men or women. And, you know, the idea of actually physically acting out with a woman doesn't particularly appeal to me. So I figured out that I guess I'm basically straight. I don't know. But one thing I really like about essays is that we stay away from those labels. You know, I figure, you know what, I'm a sexaholic. My disease took me this way, it took me that 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 way. But I noticed I felt a lot of shame about the same-sex stuff, particularly, how often does the Roman Catholic Church get blamed for stuff? But, you know, in my way of thinking, you know, girls weren't even supposed to be sexual, much less whatever. But anyway, I'm glad. And if anybody has a good answer for the question, when people tell me, I talk about essay, and, well, aren't they homophobic? Don't they not like gays or whatever? If anyone has a good reply for that, I'm interested in it because I'm really tired of, oh, good. Thank you.
My name is Jerry, sexaholic. And I've been celibate from others since July 20th of 1984, which is to say from men because it's the only encounters I ever had. And from masturbation since 1987. In looking over my life, I've had every possible thing happen to me that could make me homosexual. I was abused by a man at the age of about 4, which veered my whole way of thinking about sexual pleasure from the male rather than the female. I had two parents of which they were in an unhappy marriage. My mother felt she needed a compensation prize for the man she married, and that was going to be me. She never touched me physically, but emotionally, I was her boyfriend. I wasn't her son. And I was just too weak to get out from under that. There's a certain amount of shame in that. Just to fast forward a little bit, in the last year, finally, I forgave both of them for that. I tried to see where they were coming from in life. And then from her point of view, she's desperate. She needs something to cling to, and it happened to be me. Well, anyway, fast forwarding a lot. Because of the fact that neither one of them was really mature enough to get married, a lot of the raising of their five other children, I was the oldest, fell upon me, which turned me into a real isolationist. I learned masturbation. And during my 20s, which a lot of people say, wow, you got all those hormones raging and everything, I was celibate. I did it by means of going to daily mass and living off the grace that comes from my Catholic mass. And that was the same time I got my college education, which entailed working all day long except for sleeping 3 hours every night. Well, when I graduated and got into my first job, I had lots of time on my hands. And finally, I could see myself slipping away. And I took a vacation to San Francisco one time. I'm an architect, and I love old buildings, and San Francisco is just loaded with them. I love getting lost among all those streets with the gingerbread houses. Well, I ran out of that stuff in about 4 days, and I said, I heard they got gay bars in this town. So I found one, to make a long story short again, and I remember it was one of these with the western swinging doors. On the other side was this great big jukebox with all these colored lights. It was like getting sucked into a vortex, and the song which became the theme song of my whole 11 years in the gay lifestyle was Peggy Lee singing, "Is That All There Is?" If you remember that song. Honest to God, that was it. So anyway, when I got back to Chicago, I eventually went through three male lovers, the second of which was live-in. The other two were not. A very abusive relationship. And while I was in that lifestyle, when they were gone finally, I used to go out. I changed from my regular clothes to my cruising clothes because, as you know, you got to look good. You got to pump iron and all that stuff. And sometimes I'd find sex and other times I wouldn't. And when I finally got into this program, I realized what I was looking for was my dad that I felt had rejected me. And I found, I was saddled with this shame thing. It's like a vicious circle. On the one hand, I'm so ashamed of being homosexual that I'm second class. Now I'm second class, so I can't talk about the shame. I started coming to these meetings, and for about 6 months, I didn't say anything. And finally, I said, I think I can trust these guys. And I started talking about this stuff. Working the program, and by making the phone calls, receiving the phone calls, I got that intimacy I was looking for. And I used to have a rule. If I let 3 days go by, it goes up. The lust quotient goes up. If I talk to people every day about my feelings, wonderful. There's no lust quotient. So maybe that's the note that I'll leave it on.
We're really out of time, but real quick.
For those of you who don't know, we've got a website with some information and sharing about same-sex lust recovery in SA. I'll announce it for the tape. It's geocities.com/Canberra, Paul. That's Canberra as in the capital of Australia and Paul as in the saint. Thanks. And I'll have these flyers available for anyone who wants them. They're all also available to download off the website so you can put them in your meetings.
Thanks. I would just encourage you as we wrap up here, first of all, another quick comment I wanted to make was, you know, one of the blessings and gifts of this program has been to be able to begin to have intimate male-to-male relationships that are not sexually based. What an incredible gift. As we close, I would like to read a vision for you. But before I do, look around the room. Look around the room and see who else is in this room, because they are your resource. During the rest of this conference, you can go talk to some of these guys and share and ask questions. Take advantage of what's here. A vision for you. We realize what? Only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick? The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you can't transmit something you haven't got. So see to it that your relationship with Him is right. And what will happen? Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. That is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand Him. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us, if you will. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge where? The road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Let's have the serenity prayer as we close.
Can we make a circle?
Circle if we can, sure.